Well, welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And today we're going to be speaking to Steve Gowans. And the article is What's Left, the column is What's Left, the U.S. War to Destroy China's Crown Jewel and Secure U.S. Cyber Supremacy. Stephen Gallant. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Phil.
The notes you strike is from the beginning of your article is very important, in my opinion. It's you're using language, well, like the title says, destroy. And this seems to be the vocabulary of the U.S. now toward China. The language of aggression is their language. I notice most commentators, though, for some reason, want to neutralize it. They don't seem to listen closely to how really nasty Trump and Biden and Bolton and others are when they talk. And then they say, well, that we have a rivalry. To my knowledge, China has never said that they want to destroy any U.S. telecom people or any of that. And if you link this, you begin with the, of course, reference to the Meng Wanzhou case, citing the fact that she's an executive of a company and it's way out of whack in terms of international law and governance of behavior of companies to criminalize an individual member of a corporation, which the U.S. has done. So just with that, you want to explain what they're up to and why they're using taking such extraordinary steps.
Yes, and they are taking extraordinary steps. In Canada, perhaps the most salient step that they've taken that is a step that has commanded the most attention is the arrest of Meng Wanzhou. But this campaign against Huawei is a multi-layered campaign. And the arrest of Meng Wanzhou is just a small part of it. And since 2010, Washington has spied on Huawei. It has declared it a national security threat, whose equipment must be banned from telecom networks. It's starved it of the US technology it needs. It's subjected the company to a campaign of legal harassment, including the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, but it goes beyond that. And recently, they've also been paying Huawei's potential customers to buy from its competitors, which is quite extraordinary. But this was a plan that was developed within the Trump administration and continues into the Biden administration. And it was a plan that was described as having the US state get deep into the private market to undermine Huawei. Mm-hmm.
You know, when I first heard about this dispute prior to the apprehension of Meng Wanzhou, the financial officer. I remember reading a woman based in Beirut, Charmaine Narwani, and she said, I want Huawei. I really want that because the Americans apparently can't get into it. She said, and I would like to have a Huawei phone that the Americans can't crack. That's part of the problem, isn't it? I mean, it really underneath this is U.S., as you write, they intend to follow with, they want to be able to tap into everybody's product. And they don't want to see one on the market they can't get into.
Yeah, and I should have said, so I spelled out the campaign, but I didn't spell out the reasons for the campaign. And the reasons for the campaign would be to cripple Huawei. That's the objective. The reason is first to slow China's technological ascent and to condemn China indefinitely to low wage manufacturing. Because, I mean, if you look at China's, economic rise has been celebrated. It's pointed out that in terms of GDP, China has the second largest GDP, or if you measure it in terms of purchasing power parity, it's greater than the size of the US economy. But if you look at GDP per capita, GDP per capita in China is very low, both on a world scale and compared to the United States. And if China wants to grow its GDP per capita, which is something that it wants to do to continue to raise the standard of living of the Chinese people, it has to go beyond its current low-wage manufacturing role within the global economy. And that means moving into the kinds of areas that the United States has traditionally dominated, not only the United States, but other Western countries. And those are the leading edge industries, which have large margins, kind of industries that you can monopolize, because as someone once said, I mean, one of the objectives of successful capitalism is to build monopolies. So if you're first into the markets or the industries of the future, you're more likely to have a kind of monopoly or oligopolistic position, which enables you to generate considerable profits. You don't want to be in a position where you're doing low-wage manufacturing forever, because if China's in that position, it's going to have problems raising the standard of living of its people. So it's looking to move into the industries of tomorrow, 5G, and that's where Huawei was a leader, robotics, you know, electrical vehicles, that kind of industry. But if you condemn China indefinitely to low-wage manufacturing, you allow U.S. investors to reap the bounty of tomorrow's industries at the expense of Chinese enterprise, which can't move into that sector. And you allow the United States and the Western world to continue to dominate the, you know, the upper levels of the hierarchy or the global economic hierarchy. I mean, China is on this path to try to overcome the so-called great divergence that happened in when you had the world, which was largely the same in terms of economic development 500 years ago. And then you have this divergence where you have Western countries or the Western world take off at the expense of the rest of the world. China is trying to overcome that great divergence, and part of that is climbing the ladder from low-wage manufacturing, or as other colonial countries and former colonial countries have been consigned to the role of, relegated to the role of being drawers of water and hewers of wood. Well, they want to go beyond that. And Huawei is one of the companies that's going beyond that. But so that's part of the reason for this campaign. The other part is the one you just referred to, which is telecom networks are the infrastructure by which U.S. intelligence gathers information around the world, and also an important infrastructure through which U.S. Cyber Command could carry out offensive cyber operations. Well, Huawei, being a very successful telecom company, building 5G gear that was they were the leaders in 5G. They are the leaders in 5G network equipment. Telecom companies loved Huawei's gear, and they love Huawei's gear because it's high quality and it's less expensive than that provided by Huawei's Western competitors. For example, in Canada, Bell and TELUS had both purchased Huawei network equipment for their 5G networks because they thought it was the best equipment. And it was also cost competitive. And both Bell and TELUS were quite aggrieved that they had to rip this equipment out of their networks, or aggrieved that they cannot continue by installing Huawei's 5G equipment in the core of their networks. The United States and Britain were very concerned that Huawei would drive its Western competitors out of the 5G market because it was such a successful company. But if it did that, the Chinese company is very unlikely to cooperate with US intelligence or US cyber command. So we've heard a lot about concerns that Huawei, may have acted as an agent of the Chinese government to engage in espionage. But I think the real concern was not that Huawei would cooperate with the Chinese in spying upon the Americans and the Canadians and the Australians and the British, but that it wouldn't cooperate with the NSA and with the US Cyber Command in either collecting or spying on, all the countries around the world, or using the infrastructure as a way of mounting cyber operations.
Speaking to Stephen Gowans, matter of Huawei and the US intention or desire to destroy it, on your last point, actually, nobody's produced, I'll ask you, is there evidence that Huawei is has passed on any intelligence, actually deliberately acquired it? The allegation's been laying there. Where's the evidence?
Yeah, well, interestingly, the NSA penetrated Huawei's computers in 2010. And they did so for two reasons. First was to find out whether Huawei was an espionage threat, because there was the hypothesis that Huawei was really a front for the Chinese military.
And we spied on them to see if they're spying.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason they thought this might be the case was because the CEO and founder of Huawei, Ren Zhengfei, had been in the Chinese military and had worked in an engineering corps. So they thought, well, maybe he's still in the Chinese military and Huawei is simply a Chinese military operation.
There was a point in American history where everybody had been in the military. And including myself, I don't understand. Well, I do, but I mean, it is kind of galling that they can get someone for serving in his country's army. He didn't say he was in military intelligence or, that kind of, say like George Bush, who was once the head of the CIA. And then they made him ambassador to China, as a matter of fact. And many people said, that's curious, a CIA man becoming the ambassador. But in this case, it's just a guy who happened to have served in the army.
Right, and they spied on Huawei, and they could not provide or find any evidence to suggest that in fact Huawei was, an extension of the Chinese military. Despite that was in 2010. Despite that, 2 years later, the U.S. Congress declared Huawei to be a national security threat, and effectively blocked Huawei's access to the U.S. market. But another thing that the NSA was doing in 2010, it had two goals when it penetrated Huawei's computers. One was, as I said, to find out whether Huawei was an espionage threat, which they couldn't confirm. And secondly, to look for a back door into the company's network equipment. And we know this from
Snowden.
And I mean, if you read the New York Times talking about the documents that Snowden had leaked, I mean, what the NSA was saying was, well, we're looking for a backdoor because that way, when Huawei sells its network equipment to various countries around the world, then we can spy on them. And also we can use their equipment for cyber operations. So, I mean, the NSA, the United States, intended to use Huawei's equipment to do exactly what they're accusing the Chinese government of intending to do with Huawei's equipment. But no one has ever been able to provide any evidence to suggest that Huawei equipment is being used by the Chinese government for espionage, which was something that really irked companies like TELUS and Bell, who said, I mean, this is all misdirection. I mean, there's no legitimate national security concern here. This is simply a commercial dispute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a commercial dispute with the declared goal of preventing a developing country, really uniquely successful at breaking out of this great division of the world you spoke of. Because, you know, we have socialist countries, but to do what China has done puts the issue on a whole different level when they have more of this and more of that and quicker this and more educated, and they are trading everywhere. They have not succeeded in bottling them up, and they seem to be getting into a panic mode, the way they talk. I mean, this idea that you will cripple, you will destroy. And I want to ask that question about development of China, which it has been, I think, is a consensus, everybody agrees, an amazing success story. They 800 million people lifted out of poverty, the ability to handle a pandemic, their industry that failed, and all that. And now Biden says, okay, this stops with, you know, it stops here with me because it's not going to happen on my watch that they continue. He's not just talking to China. What he's saying to that part of the world, which is more than two thirds in population, you're not going to develop. And I'm going to see to it you don't develop. Isn't that right?
No, that's absolutely it. And, I mean, it was Bolton who has really stepped up the war on, or initiated the new phase in the war on Huawei. And what prompted him to do so was a report from telecom executives in the United States who said, well, this is the first time the United States supremacy in high tech has ever been challenged. And there's this notion that it can't be challenged, that you cannot let the Western world be challenged by any of these upstarts elsewhere in the world, that Western supremacy is sacrosanct and must forever be protected, which is another way of saying, as you just pointed out, this is the way of saying we're not going to allow the rest of the world to develop. Yeah. It has to occupy its place in the global economy, and China's place, according to the United States, is to be a low-wage manufacturing center for U.S. firms. That's the desired role for China. Mm-hmm.
Designated work. In terms of our nomenclature or way of describing, China has said, and given the characterization of them, the demonization, it's very interesting, their own language. In his speech at the 100th anniversary of success of the party, President Xi said, we have reached the point of, he said, moderately prosperous populism, which, you know, that's not American lingo or British lingo, moderately prosperous. That is taken as throwing down the gauntlet, a fight to the death. And again, you know, it's like, I guess Freud would say, you seem to be projecting. I mean, actually, what China is doing in terms of what it would offer the Canadian people, as Huawei was part of our economy, I hope it is, and for Europe. But you we're saying, no, you can't have a superior product. We're gonna make sure you get a product. It won't be as good as that, but it'll be ours. It's a very peculiar, how is that offering much future to those out who find themselves under capitalist rule in the West?
No, I mean,
convoluted. I said a convoluted. I apologize.
But it is. It's. We were talking about the great divergence, and this is simply a way of maintaining that great divergence of saying that China has been too successful in overcoming it, and it's time to undermine China.
It threatens to knock a hole in the divergence, right? I mean, as a matter of fact, it seems to have knocked a hole in it. That is, China is with the Belt and Road. It has a program which is, I would think, from a business point of view of all other states, infinitely doable, something they would think, why not? There's no reason for them to regard it as an adversarial thing. It's a chance for them to develop as well.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we have uproars in places like Bangladesh where people suspect that what that is an attempt to prevent China reaching, you know, establishing a part of the Belt and Road through Bangladesh. And all along, it's where they would like to do business. Problems are developing. But it is a successful model. Isn't it interesting that the U.S., for example, is sort of bankrupt? They're talking about their own model, the answer to Belt and Road. And what is the answer? I mean, if somebody said it's a little something on paper, but not much. But they're in a position of thinking they're going to compete with Belt and Road?
Yeah, well, it's an attempt to undermine Belt and Road. I don't think they're going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, from the US perspective, this is really motivated by profit-making concerns and Chinese enterprises encroaching upon what was once considered a Western monopoly. And now it looks like these industries aren't Western monopolies. But Biden presents this in a frightening way. He's always talking about China trying to dominate the industries of tomorrow. They're going to dominate. And really the fight is about, are we going to even allow them to enter the industries of tomorrow? Because if you allow them to enter the industries of tomorrow, and they don't dominate, but they simply participate, they become stronger, and Chinese enterprises become stronger, which only enhances or increases the amount of competition then that US enterprises have to encounter. And as I was pointing out, I mean, one of the roots to successful capitalism is to build monopolies. Well, China is encroaching upon the Western monopoly, which threatens U.S. and Western, I shouldn't say capitalism, it threatens Western and U.S. Capitalists and their profits.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to Stephen Gowans, What's Left, and I really urge listeners to go to the articles at What Left, particularly this one on the plan or the attempt to bring down Huawei. By the way, one slightly troubling aspect of your language, you were using past tense. You said Huawei was this and that, but you mean by that, I assume that they were going to be in our market, now they're not, but Huawei is not going away.
They're not going away, but certainly the United States is carrying out a very concerted effort to undermine them. I mean, by blocking their participation in 5G within the countries of the so-called Five Eyes, by pressuring countries beyond the Five Eyes to block Huawei gear. I mean, Huawei phones might be around, but I mean, the big profitable part of their company is the is 5G gear, telecom,
I guess,
network gear.
They have a share of the world market. Is it falling dramatically, or what?
I think it's inevitable that it will. I mean, because they're blocked from the U.S. market. They're being pushed out of the Canadian, the British market, the Australian market, the New Zealand market. The Americans are now talking to other countries and saying to telecom companies in those countries, well, are you going to be a clean telecom? Or are you going to be a dirty telecom that uses Huawei equipment? And if so, then we'll deal with you accordingly. And then, I mean, as I mentioned at the outset, they're also paying countries to buy from Huawei's competitors.
Bribery. So, use the word inducement, bribery, right?
Yeah. So, for example, the British telecom firm, or a British telecom firm, has led a consortium in, I can't recall where it was, Ethiopia, I think, to build a cellular network. They're getting a $500 million loan from the United States, but it's on the condition that they don't use Huawei equipment. Congress is about to pass legislation which would allow Eastern European countries to use US aid to build cellular networks so long as they use equipment providers other than Huawei. Yes. So this is, I mean, this is really a concerted effort to destroy that company, or if not to destroy it, at least to restrict it to certain parts of the world.
Yeah. In terms of technology and the development, I mean, part of their language is, well, we have to remain number one. I don't know that this demonstrates that they're going to remain number one in terms of development. You're talking about they're going to make sure that they can, basically, they're going to try to squeeze out competition from Chinese companies, right? But in terms of technology, even what constitutes 5G, my understanding is China's quite a ways ahead in this. If you say, well, you can't come in here, you haven't caught up with them in terms of the development of the technology.
Right. But I mean, if the United States was not using state measures to intervene in the market, I mean, here's the United States always professing to be a champion of the free market and free enterprise and free trade. It's not any of those things. And this demonstrates it's using the state to intervene in the market to undermine a company that is competing with U.S. and Western firms. If the United States didn't do that, Huawei would dominate the global market for 5G and telecom equipment because it's such a good company, so well respected. As I mentioned, London, Washington are afraid, were afraid that Huawei was going to drive companies like Nokia and Ericsson out of business because they're that good. But Huawei isn't going to achieve that kind of success that it would have achieved otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, the Chinese argue that, well, this it's a self-defeating thing. Well, you know, you look down the road to China's capacity, and, you know, someone might want to revisit it in 5 years and say, what did we get out of this? Because a lot of people, one assumes other countries, say in a country like Ethiopia, might decide, why are we doing this? I mean, we would be better off with, you know, buying for China and developing with them because they offer us a better product and less interference in our affairs. I wonder, I mean, China isn't just being philosophical when they say it's going to hurt you more than it hurts us.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess it's difficult to avoid the temptation when the United States is offering essentially to buy, to pay for your cellular network.
Money isn't to go buy your
And this is an interesting issue for China, because China's approach to this point has been almost to not to threaten the United States to participate in the global economy, but it's reached a point where the United States is no longer willing to regard it as a partner and now sees it as a competitor and a threat.
Well, and they use that word competition, but as you point out, most of the language is language like destroy, cripple. You quote Wall Street Journal saying, you know, we're going to get rid of their favorite company. And I mean, that's like war. I mean, that's trade. That is trade war with an axe.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But yeah. And I think the other important part, though, is also the part about espionage. And could the United States ever tolerate a case in which China dominated the telecom network gear market if Huawei, as a Chinese company, was unlikely to cooperate with U.S. espionage? I mean, I think it just underscores the ubiquity of U.S. espionage and the extent to which the United States has engaged in spying around the world, not only on so-called enemies, but also on its so-called allies, and the extent to which it dominates cyber warfare and cyber operations, while complaining bitterly that, you know, countries like Russia and China and North Korea are carrying out cyber warfare attacks against the United States. When in fact, it's the United States, which is certainly has the greatest cyber operation capability.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gowan, and I want to make sure I take up this. Well, two issues here. The Canadians are familiar with this odd language America develops. They do it. They and get involved in a trade deal. And then U.S. makes a decision completely outside the deal, which shortchanges Canada. And they say, we did that for a national security reason.
Mm-hmm.
And Canada said, well, we're not a threat. And then and that gets all shrugged off. But then, you know, the U.S. pulls this with other countries, and Canada's silent as a church mouse. They don't say anything. I mean, they've been slapped, absolutely slapped in broad daylight by the Americans with the language of national security for why we can't sell a product to them. They don't. And yet everyone, NDP, Green Party, Conservatives, Bloc, Liberals, all applaud when the U.S. says we're going to destroy Huawei.
Uh-huh.
There's a national security. I mean, we don't have a grown-up political culture, do we?
No, I mean, the national security pretext is so transparent as well. And as you point out, it's used against Canada frequently in such absurd ways that are laughable ways. It's like,
what did our army do to them?
That's right. I mean, And this goes back for decades and decades, or the United States simply for expedience will say, well, okay, that's a national security issue, so we cannot import X from Canada.
No more apples, that's it. We have to be careful. Well, now, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans, what's left. I want to make sure you cast a considerable light on the issue of Meng Wanzhou. Her case keeps coming up. And you call it a kidnapping. And you point out that, I believe it, is it Eddie Goldenberg? someone, a constitutional authority, said none of this needs to be going on. Could you talk about it? One, showing it's a kidnapping, and two, why Canada does not have to be holding her?
Well, I think when Trump said that he would intervene in her case if by doing so he could secure a better trade deal with China, he was essentially admitting that arresting Meng, or asking Canada to arrest Meng, was political kidnapping, that he intended to use her as a bargaining chip. And then there's the issue of why she was arrested, or why her extradition was requested by the United States. And ostensibly because it said that she had lied to a bank or to banks to aid Huawei in circumventing US sanctions against Iran. And then a lot of the arguments are about, well, you know, this case really isn't about sanctions, it's really about bank fraud. And bank fraud is a crime in both Canada and the United States. Sanctions have absolutely nothing to do with it. That's at least the argument that US prosecutors are using. Meng's lawyers argue that it's a fiction to say that the United States, well, essentially what the United States is, I should back up. I mean, one of the curious features of this is that the misdeeds that Meng has allegedly committed seem to have very little to do with the United States, because they occurred in Hong Kong. The alleged victim, or one of the alleged victims, HSBC, is a British bank, and the accused is a Chinese national. So what has this to do with the United States? The only connection is sanctions. The allegation is that Meng lied to the bank, the British bank, and she lied in Hong Kong. And Meng being a Chinese national. So in other words, bank fraud was committed in Hong Kong, or at least that's the allegation. So what has this to do with the United States? So their argument is, obviously the United States has no interest in policing private dealings between a foreign bank and a foreign citizen in Hong Kong. There's no connection with the United States. So, however, it is the case that the United States has an interest in enforcing its sanctions policy. So it's really sanctions that are driving this case, not bank fraud. And then they go on to argue that what fraud means is fraud, and they don't concede that Meng lied. But they said, but if, let's assume she did lie to a bank in Hong Kong, a British bank in Hong Kong. If she did, it doesn't become fraud unless the victim, or the party that was deceived, suffers some kind of injury, and the person who did the deceiving, or the party that practiced the deception, suffers some kind of gain. Well, in Canada, would Meng have enjoyed some kind of gain, and would HSBC have suffered some kind of harm? Well, no, they wouldn't. There'd be no harm to the bank and no gain to Meng, because there are no extraterritorial sanctions in Canada. So this argument that bank fraud was committed in Canada is an argument which her lawyers argue is indefensible, untenable, it doesn't stand up. Mm-hmm. But I mean, another curious feature of this case is that when companies violate US extraterritorial sanctions, the United States doesn't arrest their executives. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of cases of US banks and international banks violating US sanctions, and those corporations are fined. Executives aren't arrested. Just recently, the software giant SAP paid $8 million in fines for selling software to Iran, the company executives weren't arrested. The company wasn't even prosecuted. Instead, it was let off with a promise to improve its compliance. But Meng's case is very unusual in that an executive was arrested. And that was Goldenberg's argument, is once, I mean, that you behaved in such an unusual fashion illustrates or demonstrates this is a political case. Mm-hmm. And a political kidnapping, if we consider that Trump said that he would withdraw the extradition request if he could get a better trade deal with China. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's part of, also a part of this legal harassment that's part of the campaign to destroy Huawei. It's not only Meng, but the United States has brought other suits against Huawei. And Huawei also claims that the FBI makes visits to Huawei employees, either current employees or former employees, to try to recruit them as informants, or to give them information that might be used to launch more suits.
Yeah, in related matter, and I mean, this is part of the basic thesis of how aggressive and jingoistic policy is. The United States has a thing called the China Initiative. We were talking about our show last week, in which decision, it was by the United States Congress and executive, they said, they directed the attorneys generals of all U.S. states and all districts and territories to start looking into Chinese or Asian students, and to, you know, with the intent of prosecution. When there was no complaint, they had nothing. They said, basically, go and find something. And when they bring them to court, it always involves, it must be espionage. They love that word. And then eventually some scientist said, yeah, when I filled out that form, I didn't mention that I once worked at this university, but nobody ever asked me about that before. And they said, oh, see, you lied to us. I mean, and in the process, they also say that we learn that many of these scientists who've been picked up and mistreated and embarrassed, an attempt was made to recruit them.
Yes.
I mean, and yet we go along here in Canadian politics and whatnot with that kind of behavior, when we should be saying, let's toss this whole thing out. And that was another point has been made by many, right? I mean, this is not complicated. It is within the power of the prime minister and the justice minister, I guess, to just dispense with this case.
Yes, it is.
But the NDP would be angry. The Social Democrats would want to see the record. And the Greens would want to see. And the Bloc would be punching the air. I mean, this is where we are, right? We're in a perfect storm of stupidity.
Yes. Well, yes, there was that faction of the Liberal Party that has argued that the Prime Minister and the Minister of Justice ought to release Meng. But I mean, this simply shows the extent to which Canada is, a vassal of the United States. Occasionally, Canada shows some backbone and some independence, but that's not the usual route or common practice.
Yeah, it's a trend which actually, we went from a Chartrand friend in the foreign minister's job to Freeland, and that was goodbye to the idea of the promise. People don't remind Trudeau. He promised he's going to make better relations with Russia, better relations with China, and better relations with Iran. Oh, my goodness. All that is gone. It's like, did I say that? But you're right. The only argument, political argument of any note, seems to be within the Liberal Party, and in which the advocates of that rational policy with a backbone, the advocates are being drowned quietly in the back room, I think. Stephen, I want to thank you again. It's a great article on what's left. I think you've really picked out the right matter. The question for all of us is, why do we go along with this? But thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil.
It was fun to talk to you.